Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society.
My name is Mo Korchinski. I'm the executive director of Unlocking the Gate Service Society. We're a peer-run organization that supports people who are incarcerated and do release planning, pick them up from the gate and support them in the community and try to keep people alive.
My name is Heather Palace. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, in the Department of Psychiatry, and also am affiliated with the BC Centre for Disease Control and BC Mental Health and Substance Use Services. And I'm very grateful to work closely with Mo and others on research related to health outcomes and access to services for people released from prison.
Now, you're two of the co-authors of an article entitled Association of Mental Health Services Access and Reincarceration Among Adults Released from Prison in British Columbia, Canada. It was published December 15th, 2022 in the journal JAMA Network Open. The title pretty much explains it, I guess, but could you expand on it? What were you looking at?
So we looked at people who were released from provincial prisons in BC and who had a recent diagnosis of mental illness. And provincial prisons in BC, just for some context, are places where people are going if they're sentenced to less than 2 years. And they do have quite a high rate of reincarceration. So we know that about half of people who are released will be reincarcerated within 2 years. And that rate's even higher for people who have a mental illness diagnosis. So in this study, we were looking at the rate of reincarceration for people who were and who were not able to access community mental health services. And what we found was that people who were able to access those services had about a 40% lower chance of being reincarcerated. And we also found that the sooner people were able to access those services, the better. So for every month that passed between being released and accessing services in community, there was a 5% increase in risk of reincarceration. So what that means is, you know, if it took 6 months for someone to access services, their risk of being reincarcerated increased by 30%. So really, we are just focused on emphasizing the need for interventions immediately when people are released and planning for that release so that they have that contact with care as soon as they go back to the community.
Now, I want to ask about the kinds of mental health needs that were among the population you were looking at. But first, as I mentioned, you're in the farthest north part of Abya-Yala. We're down here in the part currently known as the United States. And different systems, obviously, much, much different systems. Among other things, your government has endorsed the idea of universal health coverage. How successful they are at achieving it is up for debate, but at least they've endorsed the idea. Down here, it's still a very controversial issue. My home state of Oregon, in fact, in the most recent, just back in November, adopted a constitutional amendment to our state constitution that that endorsed the that guarantees every Oregonian the right to health care, and which is sort of the first state in the country to do that. It's kind of cool. We're going to have to find out what exactly that means. Sorry, long preamble, but again, much different systems was the point. What kinds of services are actually available for people up in your neck of the woods?
Okay, I'll talk about the prison part. Heather, you can talk about community. So for our provincial prison system, I think 3 years ago, our before that, our health care was privatized inside the correctional centers. So there was no through care, in care. So there was really, you know, if you were on medication when you got arrested, you basically had to start over when you got in. Your medication, what you're on, didn't follow through. But now our provincial health care has taken over the health care. So we've seen a huge improvement, definitely better with mental health and services. Mental health is... knees are definitely on the rise. Lots to do with the overdose crisis, what we have here in BC. You know, so we're on 7 years of the overdose crisis. You know, lots of brain damage units inside of our correctional centers now. I think almost every correctional center at least has one or two brain damage units now. So if they connect with the services before they get released, you know, it follows through, but a lot of people don't connect with mental health services or healthcare services. So what my organization does is that we connect with people before they get out. We help with them with release planning. Problem is, if you have a mental health disorder, or if you have, or you're struggling with mental health or addiction, you're banned from most of the shelters. You can't go to treatment. We have most of our treatment centers. You have to be on the street for 30 days before you can go to a treatment center. So we do really leave, there's a huge gap there. So it really is important that they connect with the mental health and healthcare services before they get released. So there is a better chance that they'll have services when they get released. Once you get released and you don't have mental health services, it's almost zero impossible for somebody to get a mental health help. Of course, you have to go to a psychologist, and, you know, if you, especially if you're homeless and you're back into addiction. You know, it's just this revolving door, a lot of barriers we put up. So, yeah, that's about with the correctional part. Definitely say we're grateful now that, the government has taken over the healthcare. It's definitely a huge improvement. But again, there's still so many people that don't see healthcare. You know, so many people go in only for 5 days, 7 days, long enough just to get off the dope, long enough to lose everything. And then they get released again back into nothing. Right. We don't have any supportive housing for people. Most shelters and communities are run by one organization. So if you get banned from that one, you're banned from community shelters. So you don't have access to food, clothing, shelter. So that's the biggest thing with population, you know, people coming out, is they're in survival mode, right? You know, they don't have anything, right? Everything is, they got a clear plastic bag, and, you know, they're released and say, hey, figure it out on your own. And that's where our organization comes in, to make sure people aren't falling through the cracks and aren't dying, because they're a higher risk of overdosing the first 2 weeks of being released. And that's what we try to do, is support people. So, right. Because right now we're losing way too many people to this overdose crisis, as well as you guys in the States, or your numbers are crazy on the overdose crisis as well. So, and I'll pass it to Heather to talk about community.
Thanks, Mo. Yeah, I guess on the community piece, I was thinking similarly what Mo shared around the survival mode piece. So if people have all of these competing needs when they leave, like trying to find housing, trying to find food, transportation issues, that makes healthcare less accessible and maybe, you know, is not the number one priority because there are so many needs when you're leaving. So, in terms of what we looked at in this study, are measures of mental health services access. They came from health records, and they were health records for things like community counseling, primary care visits, hospitalizations, emergency department visits. And about half overall of the visits that we had were for primary care. But the other half in the study were for, as I mentioned, other pieces like emergency departments, hospitalization. So I think one of the challenges is that if people aren't in a position to be able to prioritize their health because they're facing so many other barriers, health needs might get left behind. And then people end up hospitalized or in emergency departments because they haven't been able to prevent that by seeing primary care practitioners. So that was another interesting finding in this study, is that people who were actually in contact with healthcare through primary care had a lower risk of a reincarceration compared to people that were in contact with mental health care in a hospital or in an emergency department.
And it's not the first place, you know, the most vulnerable or the most marginalized population want to go to his emergency because there's so much stigma around it, and they're treated like garbage, right? So most people really avoid that, you know, emergency rooms or healthcare, because they're so stigmatized and treated, you know. So, yeah.
I guess on that note, I wonder, Mo, if you can talk more about, like, one of the things that I think Unlocking the Gates does really well is helps to bridge people to those services when they're ready, because there is that stigma. Maybe you don't want to go on your own, but you'll go to the doctor if an Unlocking the Gate staff is going to come with you. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big piece of what your organization does to support.
I mean, this is the reason why we started Unlocking the Gates, because for me, I've been out 17 years. Everybody who works for my organization all have lived experience of incarceration and addiction. And we all know what it's like when we got released. You know, you get treated like garbage. You go, any appointment you go to, you just get talked down to. You know, we don't really give people much dignity. And the whole point of was Unlocking the Gates was to walk beside people and really, you know, give them dignity and make sure that other people, other organizations who their work we want to connect them to, you know, treat them with dignity. You know, and also the other biggest one about us is giving people hope. You know, most people know we've all been incarcerated, remember us from being incarcerated. And, you know, it's like, well, how did you do it? Like, you know, how are you running an organization? How are you driving a car? How do you have your children back in your life? You know, or you got your grandkids, you know, so giving people dignity and hope and a purpose when they get out, everybody needs those three things in life. And we do a really bad job when we release people. I always say we unlock the gate to the prison, but we don't unlock the gate to society. And that's where Unlocking the Gates comes in, to make sure that we are opening the gate to society and walking beside people, you know, if it's treatment or if it's, if they even want to go back to the street, you know, making sure that they got, you know, safe supply or, you know, Narcan or access to, you know, clothing and food. I mean, we get people who get arrested in the summer and get out in winter with flip-flops and shorts, right? You know, and making sure they have clothes. It's just the basic needs, what most of us take for granted here, that you can open up a fridge and get food, you know. And if you're banned from a shelter, it's usually the only place where you can get food. So a lot of people who can't even go to a shelter or access food, right? So we have huge food insecurity. And, you know, and I'm telling you, and going back to the street is non-judgmental. Going back to, you know, back to all your street buddies and back to homeless camps, it's so welcoming. And but we don't do that with society. We don't welcome people back. And I always say it takes a community to raise a child. It takes a community to support somebody who's trying to change their, turn their life around and try to bridge them back into being, you know, somebody in society. And yeah, so that's where Unlocking the Gates comes. We work with the whole province. We work with 10 provincial prisons across the province. I have staff from one end of the province to the other. This year alone, we've done over 1,600 clients. We have done release planning, picking up at the gate, and supporting the community.
This is my conversation with Dr. Heather Pallas, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of British Columbia at the BC Center for Disease Control and BC Mental Health and Substance Use Services, and Mo Korchinski, executive director of the Unlocking the Gates Service Society. They're two of the co-authors of an article entitled Association of Mental Health Services Access and Reincarceration Among Adults Released from Prison in British Columbia, Canada, that was published December 15, 2022 in the journal JAMA Network Open. We'll have more in a moment. I'm Doug McVeigh. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. So now, look, I'm particularly interested in substance use. That really didn't sound right. Substance use is one of my fields of expertise, which doesn't really sound right either, but go with me. Just first, now, the official Safer Supply program up in BC, am I right in thinking that it's too recent to have been an option for people in your study, or did your study include that?
Yeah, so this... this timeline was only up to the end of 2018, and that kind of prescribed safer supply started rolling out in the context of COVID in 2020. So we don't have data on that, but it is something that is rolling out in community, and I think we're advocating for a range of services for people in corrections, and that could include prescribed safer supply, and right now does include opioid agonist treatment. I don't know, Mo, if you'd like to talk a bit about out in prison. I know we talked about the fact that that's been one of the big successes of the transition of the responsibility for delivering healthcare to the Ministry of Health, is that there's been a scaling up of access to opioid agonist treatment inside of correctional centers in BC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'm not sure if it's because of the provincial, healthcare took over because of the overdose crisis. But I know when I was incarcerated 17 years ago, it was impossible to get onto, you know, any kind of therapy. And it seems now like, you know, everybody's offered it right on intake. So definitely an improvement, you know, and definitely a way more dignity for people, because before, when you used to get incarcerated, you used to just be sitting in your cell, dope sick, puking, and, you know, a horrible way for somebody to come off of the dope. So, you know, definitely putting people on methadone or Suboxone or another opiate is definitely an improvement of, you know, a definitely more humane way when you're arresting somebody who's addicted to drugs. And definitely, you know, and now with the provincial health care taken over, there's definitely more follow through, that people do have a script when they leave, they can get access to their medication. And beforehand, people weren't getting, there was no follow through. You know, people would get 3 days worth of medication and were left on their own. So definitely say there's definitely a huge improvement. I think one of the biggest downfall, we're talking about drug addiction, and is the lack of services when it comes to treatment, detox. Right now, we probably have about 6 week wait for detox or treatment. We always get told, like, you know, people in society are like, well, why don't they just go to treatment and get off the dope? And I'm like, they can't go to detox, they can't go to treatment, because we just don't have those services. So we're very lacking them, like, to such long wait pits. And there's such a short window when somebody says they're ready to go. You know, they want to go today, not wait 6 weeks. Plus, also, you have to phone every day. And most of the time, they don't have a phone to phone detox. And if you miss a day, you get bumped off the list. If you don't check into a treatment center, if you don't call in, you get kicked off the list. So there's so many barriers to get it. Like, I think we need probably a good 10,000 more beds for treatment in this province, and way more detox beds if we really want to tackle this overdose crisis. My personal opinion, you know, one thing, the first thing, when people go inside, I remember almost everybody who would come in when I was incarcerated, and the same thing is like, I'm done. I'm never going to use again. I'm done. And then when it comes to time to get released, there's nowhere for them to go. There's no hope. There's no nothing, you know, sending people to a homeless shelter where, you know, people are using, it really isn't a way for somebody to turn their life around. And again, you know, coming out with no clothes, no food, no shelter, no connection to family. There's just so many barriers. And I think we can do a way better as a society of having that transition and supporting people. Yeah.
What services are, again, it's a different, you're in a different place with different, what kind of services are available for people with substance use disorder? And I mean, beyond treatment, as you were saying, if you're unhoused, if you don't have warm clothing and it's winter, I mean, there's all kinds of things that, there may be physical health needs for that matter. Yeah. What kind of services are available for people with substance use disorder, that are coming out of prison?
A long wait list. Like, I probably have about 50 people sitting inside carcer in our prison systems right now across the province, what are waiting for beds so they can get out, right? We just don't do enough. And we really need, you know, first stage housing, or like, and again, they re-season in a housing crisis. I'm not sure what it's like down there. You know, our rent's ridiculous. You know, for one bedroom, it's like $1,500. If you don't have a job, you don't have income assistance, only pays $375 for shelter. Like, we make it impossible. Like, we don't have enough low barrier or low income housing in communities, because nobody wants it in their backyard, right? Right. If you build it, they'll come, right? Instead of helping, you know, your citizens of your own community. So we really get over it's us and them, that, you know, if we help them and support them, you know, people become like me. Like, you know, since I turned my life around, I haven't, you know, picked up dope. I haven't committed crime, and I haven't gone back to jail. That's a huge cost savers to taxpayers, instead of just keep throwing them back out with nowhere to go and them being stuck in this revolving door, right? Over and over and over, right?
Yeah, and I would add to Mo's comment around, for sure, as she said, wait lists around access to detox and recovery centers for people who have a diagnosis of opioid use disorder. BC does have the opioid agonist treatment that we talked about in corrections, is quite widely available in community. But again, there are barriers if we're thinking about folks that are released in more rural parts of the province. You know, there are barriers like, how are you going to get to a physician's office? A lot of times when those medications are prescribed, people have to pick them up every day from the pharmacy. So you have to get to and from the pharmacy every day, or you're not getting your medication. So yeah, there have been increased efforts to help the continuity of those prescriptions from prison to community, but still a number of barriers to making sure that that access continues long term for people who want it.
Do you find the mental health services the same in general? I mean, in terms of the rural versus city divide. Obviously, in Vancouver, one is going to have more access to services than you would in some small town that I don't know the name of.
Oh, definitely. Like some of these commute, like up north, northern communities. You know, I mean, my staff drive people, you know, 10 hours back to the remote community, and there's basically no resources in those communities, right? So, I mean, you can't keep people in just main Vancouver area or the bigger cities, right? And we want people to go back home to their communities and connect with their families and connect with, you know, especially First Nations, you know, back to their reserves or back to their elders. But there's none. But there's other resources that aren't there, right? So, yeah. It's a big province and it's spread out. And, rural communities are got so many more barriers. You know, there's no treatments. There's no shelter beds. There's no, you know, if you get released and you're going back to a small community, there's nowhere for you to stay anyways, right? So, yeah.
Practically drives people to congregate near the large cities, just because those are the services are.
Yeah, and back to the homeless, because they're going to take care of you. If you don't have a jacket, somebody's going to get you a jacket. Oh, you need a pair of shoes? Somebody will get you a pair of shoes. Like, it's so welcoming and so forgiving. The street population, it's its own community, and I don't know why we can't create that with the main, like, broader of a community of how welcoming it is. Right. And same with the community inside corrections. Like, it's like this family and community, and we take care of each other. But we don't get that when we get released. There's so much stigma around, you know, having a criminal record, or, you know, I mean, I'm not even allowed in your country because I have a criminal record. I've been out 17 years. I'm a social worker. I'm running a nonprofit, you know, but I can't go down there because I have a criminal record. So we still hold those people, you know, people who have criminal records. It follows you for life. It's like, okay, I've done my time, but you actually really haven't done your time, because it's a lifelong sentence of always having that. So.
Well, thank goodness for Zoom.
Yes.
What questions have I not asked yet that I should?
I guess for me, this hope of this paper that we wrote and the data we collected, what really shows the importance of, you know, mental health treatment and really having services what are appropriate for people who are coming out of incarceration, and showing that, you know, the recidivism rate is less. And, you know, it's super expensive to incarcerate somebody. Like, it's not cheap. I'm not sure people realize. I know in Canada, a few years ago, I'm sure it's more because everything's gone up. It was like $300 a night for somebody in a provincial prison, you know, like super expensive. And it's over $400 for somebody who's in a federal prison. Like, if people add that up and think, well, just throw them in jail, not realizing how much money we are spending incarcerating people, you know, and that's not counting police, courts, you know, crime, you know, shoplifting to, you know, to people in the community. You know, add on and add on. Like, if we actually put the services in to really support people, and, you know, it's going to be beneficial to everybody in the community if we actually just come together and support this population instead of just saying we don't want it in our backyard. They're just, you know, it's your choice. You know, it's your choice. You're an addict. Just put it down. Da da da. I'm not looking at, you know, generations of trauma. You know, I'm not sure, like half our population, what are incarcerated are First Nations. And we know that through residential schools. And, you know, there's so much, you know, past where people don't even want to look at and look at the stories of people. And that's why I do what I do. You know, I write books, I, you know, do documentaries. I'm very open about my criminal behavior. I'm really open about my addiction. So people see, to humanize who people are on the street, because if you actually talk to them, and listen to our stories and listen to the challenges. And it's not like, oh, just give it up. It's not that easy. And this is why I like it, right? So I'm really hoping out of this paper, we realize let's put more mental health services and let's support people coming out of prison who have mental health services, right? And we have a better chance of them not going back in and out through the revolving door.
Very well said, Mo.
Thanks.
I guess the only piece we haven't really touched on that I would add or think that might be kind of interesting to the audience is one of the things that we found, we looked not just at mental illness broadly, but we looked at different diagnosis types, and the people who had the more severe mental illness, so schizophrenia and other psychotic disorder diagnosis, they had the highest risk of reincarceration. You know, depending on what we were comparing to, whether it be mood disorder or personality disorder, you know, 20 to 30% more likely to be reincarcerated. So to me, it's really speaking to, those needs for that group being unmet in community. And then we see this cycle, and revolving door that Mo spoke to in those needs not being met and returning to, prison because of the gaps for people that are having the most challenges. And in this study, it was very clear that that was the people with the more severe mental illness and also the people who had a substance use disorder diagnosis as well.
Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners?
For me, I just want everybody who's listening is when you're looking at somebody who's on the street or homeless or somebody who's an addict or somebody who's struggling with mental health, just to be kind. Kindness goes a long way. So many of us have never had anybody who actually cared about us or we actually even treated us with respect. And, you know, it only takes one person to believe in somebody for them to want it better themselves. So just be kind.
That was my conversation with Dr. Heather Pallas, a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of British Columbia, the BC Center for Disease Control, and BC Mental Health and Substance Use Services, and Mo Korchinski, executive director of the Unlocking the Gates Service Society. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kbo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Heather Pallas and Mo Korchinski. Thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.